Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this litigation update webinar on Prosecutor Hy-V Rastanen. We're very pleased to welcome our moderator, Karen Lugo, who's the founder of the Libertas West Project. If you would like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, her full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Ms. Lugo, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Sarah. Today, we're assembled to talk about a seminal free speech case in the EU based in Finland. And so we have an attorney from Alliance Defending Freedom and the litigation team for this case with us. He will be describing the case developments, and then we'll have a discussion about what the implications of this case are, both in the EU and how it might be related to some events in the United States. So today we welcome Lorcan Price, who is a barrister based in Westminster, London. He directs legal advocacy for Alliance Defending Freedom UK. Prior to this, he was based in Strasbourg, France, where he engaged in litigation at the European Court of Human Rights concerning freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and freedom of association. This was all under European human rights law. He is a graduate of the National University of Ireland, Trinity College Dublin, and the University of Oxford. So we'll turn it over to you, Lorcan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen and Sarah, and good afternoon or good evening where I am to you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to speak to you today about Päivi Räsänen's case, which we concluded oral hearings at the Supreme Court of Finland in October of last year. And we now await a decision, which I'm hopeful will be in the coming weeks, perhaps as early as mid to late February. This Supreme Court hearing has been the culmination of a very long process. I just want to give you some of the context of how we got to a hearing where Päivi was being tried under provisions of the Finnish Criminal Code to do with incitement to what they call ethnic agitation or hatred, which is in the war crimes section of the Finnish Criminal Code. But before we get to that, just to give you some background about Päivi Räsänen. Päivi is a lady who has been in politics for 25 years. She's a member of the Finnish Parliament. She sat as a minister in the Finnish government before, ironically, in the area of justice and home affairs. So she presided over the very police force and prosecution service that is now criminally prosecuting her. She is a medical doctor and a grandmother with 12 grandchildren, four of whom have been born during the currency of this particular litigation. This case really began in 2019 when she expressed her concern over Twitter in relation to the Finnish Lutheran Church's decision to use church money to sponsor or co-sponsor the Helsinki Gay Pride Parade. And she raised the question as to whether or not the church should be rising up, as she put it, something that the Bible condemns as a matter of shame. And on the basis of that tweet, she also included an image from Romans, from Scripture. This tweet elicited a criminal investigation because somebody made a criminal complaint that she had engaged in hate speech contrary to Finnish law by disparaging the gay community and associating the pride parade with what she described as a matter for shame. And The criminal complaint was then investigated by the police in 2019, and the police decided that there was no basis to the complaint and that they would not press charges any further. This decision was overruled then by the Prosecutor General of Finland at the time. The Prosecutor General of Finland decided that she was going to launch, quote unquote, a crusade against hate speech, which she believed was plaguing Finnish and European society more generally. And we'll return to the context for this decision in a moment. I think it's very important to put to give a clear picture of what's actually happening in Europe and why Päivi's case is really a microcosm of a major problem we have across the continent at the moment when it concerns free speech. The case then made its way ultimately as a result of the prosecutor's decision to the Municipal Court of Helsinki, which heard the case in 2020. By 2021, in a decision then in early 2022, the unanimous verdict of the court, which sits as a magistrate with two assistant judges, was to find her not guilty. And there's a quirk of some civil law systems, Finland included, which we don't have in the common law, whereby the prosecution service can appeal a not guilty decision. In the normal course of events, as we know, the only appeal that that results from a decision of a criminal court is usually to do with the severity of the sentence, if a prosecutor believes it's not severe enough, for example. In Finland, in common with some civil law jurisdictions, the actual verdict itself can be appealed. And in this case, the prosecution service decided to appeal the not guilty verdict to the Court of Appeal of Finland in Helsinki, which then heard the case in 2023. And another not guilty verdict was returned after significant legal argument. However, the prosecution service was still unsatisfied with that and appealed again and ended up at the highest court in Finland, which is the Supreme Court of Finland, whose decision we now await. This, I think, really captures what you might describe as the process constituting a form of punishment against Päivi. The accumulation of not guilty verdicts did not dissuade really at all the prosecution service from proceeding, because they were determined to, I believe, make an example of Päivi for engaging in what they believed is hate speech. Päivi wasn't the only accused on trial. Bishop Johanna Pauna of the Finnish Lutheran Church was also put on trial for the crime of having published a pamphlet in 2005, co-authored by Päivi Räsänen, on the nature of human sexuality, entitled God, Man and Woman, God Created Them, where she talks about the distinction between male and female and the purpose of sexuality in God's plan for human beings. This was also the subject of a criminal complaint that was included into the main issue before the court, which was the tweet, the so-called Bible case, as it became, in the Bible tweet. Bishop Pauna was similarly dragged through the courts for these past, going on now 7 years, for having facilitated the publication through the Luther Foundation, which is associated with the Finnish Lutheran Church. The core of the prosecution case relies on the following proposition, which is that in engaging in biblical exegesis or Christian commentary about human sexuality, one is entitled to hold the beliefs, and this was stated by the prosecutor in the initial first instance hearing, but communicating them in the way that affects the dignity of homosexual persons constitutes hate speech. So, in other words, the belief or the view of the Finnish prosecution service is you're entitled to hold Christian beliefs privately, but as soon as you express them publicly or publish them in either by electronic means or otherwise, you're engaged in hate speech if somebody takes offense from, in this case, the gay community. As a result of this, what the prosecution decided was that the guarantees that exist in the Finnish constitution and in international law, to which Finland is a party to, particularly Article 9 of the European Convention on Human Rights, that they stand at naught, that they do not permit hate speech. And notwithstanding the fact that this was religious-based communication, that freedom of expression and freedom of religion taken together are overridden in this instance by the rights of the complainant not to be offended or subjected to what they allege is hate speech. Now, undoubtedly, Bivey disagreed, as did Bishop Johanna, and many, many people came forward in Finland over the course of this trial to express their dissatisfaction. It became a major public issue in Finland. It was described as the Bible on trial. It was raised in the parliament and across the broadcast media and in newspapers and in, as Bivey would say herself, in many discussions and by approaches by members of the public to her. It attracted enormous controversy because it was part of a campaign by the prosecutor at that point, as I alluded to earlier, to crack down on what she saw as hate speech, which she believed, or she alleged at least, was plaguing Finland. The overall context for this, ladies and gentlemen, is a view that set in among European governing elites in the period 2015, 2016, 2017, that the culmination of the Brexit decision in the United Kingdom, the election of Donald Trump, and the so-called rise of the right in Europe constituted a real threat to European democracy, and that it was being driven in particular by online speech. So the proposition was that because people were able to freely express themselves online, they were using this as an opportunity to spread hatred, and that that hatred was having a corrosive effect on European democracy. In fact, the Prosecutor General of Finland, Riitta Häkkinen at the time, described Ivy's remarks as being tantamount to believing in the Koran or Mein Kampf, which, of course, caused particular concern in terms of how offensive this comparison was. You can believe what's written in the Quran and Mein Kampf, she said, but you're not allowed to express it in public. So that gives an insight, I think, into certainly amongst the elite in the Finnish prosecution service, that when it comes to the Christian scripture, that what it has to say is as offensive as the writings of Adolf Hitler. And that she believed that they were in one and the same when it came to the dissemination of hate speech in Finland. As I said, the context here is critical because developments such as the prosecution of Päivi Räsänen have to be seen in parallel with the developments at the European Union level of the so-called codes of conduct on hate speech that were published in 2017 and 2018, which then metastasized into the Digital Services Act, which is the primary vehicle now for controlling and content moderation of online speech in Europe. You may have seen recently that Elon Musk and X have been subject to enormous fines by the European Commission under the provisions of the Digital Services Act for facilitating, as they claim, the publication of hateful material. Albeit, in this case, the fines are actually really calibrated towards some technical matters, but what's really going on is effectively investigations around so-called hate speech. Those kind of developments at the European level were mirrored by national level legislation, which was all introduced in quite rapid succession across Europe, starting with the Network Enforcement Act in Germany, the Online Safety Act in the United Kingdom, where I'm based at the moment, and various other hate speech laws that were bolstered in multiple European jurisdictions in response to this panic over so-called radicalization and hate speech coming from online discourse. Päivi's case really does offer, I think, the best, as I said, microcosm or insight into both the view that policymakers and prosecutors at a senior level in one particular country take, but is common across the European Union at this juncture. We've seen prosecutions, for example, in Germany for people who've insulted politicians or who have questioned migration from the Islamic world. My colleagues and I are engaged in litigation here in the United Kingdom for involving preachers who are being prosecuted for preaching the gospel, where they have criticized Islam, for individuals who have been engaged in prayer, both silent prayer and audible prayer, in so-called buffer zones where prayer is excluded in public places, and a general crackdown on speech, both in public and online, that is seen to be either provocative or offensive to various minority interest groups. In particular, I would suggest Islam and the LGBT community. So Where that directly impacts, of course, with freedom of religion is that for Christians who are really called to or mandated by their deeply held belief to share the gospel, that means that you have a direct tension between that religious speech, which can be critical of certain modern lifestyle choices, and the decision that authorities have taken to protect and prioritize protecting those people from so-called offense when it involves any kind of critical view made in public or online. Our hope for Pivey's case is that she will be acquitted, as she has been successively so far, by the Supreme Court of Finland. If she is not, it's our intention then to appeal the decision to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, invoking Article 9, freedom of expression, or I beg your pardon, Article 9, freedom of religion and belief, and Article 10, freedom of expression. Alas, I think this is important for a US audience to understand, lacking as we do any robust protection from a First Amendment type guarantee in either domestic law in Europe or international law, we have a very weak and inconsistent jurisprudence from the European Court of Human Rights when it comes to defending freedom of expression. One interesting point really is the remarks recently of the Polish judge at the European Court, where he said, it depends on what you're advocating for as to whether or not the European Court will protect your freedom of expression. If you're prosecuted for advocating for fashionable beliefs, the European Court will protect it. If your beliefs are unfashionable, such as critics of Islam, migration, or LGBT, then you'll find the court is not in a position or not willing to protect your freedom of expression. So in conclusion, what I would say is this. Pivey's case is one of a number of cases that we're seeing across Europe where freedom of expression has been significantly eroded and even set aside completely by ideologically motivated prosecutors using vague and ill-defined hate speech laws to crack down on perfectly legitimate speech. We're going to see more of this, alas, as the European Union ramps up its efforts around the Digital Services Act. And it's my fear, ultimately, that when it comes to bringing these cases on appeal to the highest level courts, that consistently, particularly at the European Court of Human Rights, the right to freedom of expression is not actually vindicated in practice in any meaningful way. Our hope, however, as I said, is that Pivey will be acquitted, which will at least show in Finland, if nowhere else, that some sanity prevails when it comes to protecting freedom of speech. Thank you very much. Back to you, Karen.
Thank you. Thank you. Fascinating. And for Americans, very troubling. A couple of initial questions. First of all, as you're well aware, we always in the United States try to read the room when there are Supreme Court arguments. What was the temperature? Is there any way based on questions asked or responses or the tenor of the room to even guess what the outcome maybe, and when do you expect that there might be a decision rendered?
Well, in terms of the hearing itself, it's fascinating. Obviously, when you particularly reach a high appellate court, most of the arguments have been set out exhaustively in submissions, written submissions. So what really happened was a reiteration of the kind of key points of those submissions. That elicited very little commentary from the bench. Scandinavians are generally quite phlegmatic and difficult to unemotive, let me put it that way, speaking as an Irishman, by comparison at least. They kept their counsel very, very close. And there were some questions, but they were really very short, clarifying questions rather than anything that would suggest that they had formed a view. In terms of the timeline for the decision, we're hopeful that we'll have a decision rendered and handed down in February. They're obliged one way or the other to indicate to us in February as to whether or not they've actually reached a conclusion. If they don't, we'll be given, I think, a more definitive time. But at the moment, it's a kind of wait and see exercise, and we're hopeful that it will be February.
We will be watching. I talk often with attorneys in various parts of Europe, and it does seem to be that as far as the general population, there is a much greater interest in and greater freedom of expression. Does this percolate to the court system? Is this true first? And as the United States, I mean, certainly we're looked at as having this, and it's true, very robust open field for freedom of speech, pretty well enunciated in our Ryder v. Phelps, where the Supreme Court established that when it's a matter of public concern, there is a wide open range of robust and, you know, maybe offensive conversation, dialogue, debate that can be had. And we look at some of the cases that didn't even make it to our Supreme Court level that are some kind of difficult facts. I mean, you brought up the Islamic element, and I know there, you know, the tension between Western cultures and then these embedded societies that cling to a different kind of civilizational code. And looking at two cases here in the United States, where it was in the Sixth Circuit en banc, where a group believers paraded through and disrupted an Islamic presentation at a festival. The police refused to protect these Bible believers who were carrying pigs' heads and, you know, being very provocative. The Sixth Circuit en banc, which was a matter of several renderings below before the entire Sixth Circuit delivered a decision that kind of expression was protected, and that the police were required to protect this kind of expression, and that the police actually did not have immunity in a case like this. So there are difficult facts. I know we also have incidents in the U.S. of Quran burning where the courts have refused to say that is unprotected expressive conduct. It's there again, difficult facts, but the urge in the United States is that more speech, you know, hopefully being able to debate issues will bring us to a point where we're resolving some of the civilizational assimilation challenges that all Western cultures are facing. So I note, too, that in the United States, the kind of memo doesn't always reach localities, your city council, your county commission. I talk with people a lot in consulting who are preparing to speak to these bodies, and these local governments have an idea that if somebody's offended, that there must be a way to resolve this conflict by silencing somebody, you know, make it go away. And so this impulse at the local level, is this more what is being reflected by this prosecutorial team in Finland, where maybe they're not acknowledging the kind of overarching freedom of speech? I know you and I had a quick discussion before we launched this webinar, but Keir Starmer and his, you know, broad declaration of how there's freedom of speech in the UK, but yet, you know, we're all witnessing that the cases, certainly at the local level, do not bear that out. So is there this same kind of tension between the prosecutions that arise from local incidents where there's this kind of controversy, and what an appellate court at the highest level may render at the point that they're then declaring an overall sense of, yes, you know, there is this backstop of freedom of expression?
Well, I think the problem comes from, I would say, as a general observation, freedom of expression is being squeezed in Europe from both the local and the overarching kind of, let's say, senior domestic and international level. There is an entirely different conception of the utility of freedom of speech in amongst European policymakers, and that's why, you know, I know American audiences are kind of bemused by comments by the likes of Keir Starmer or the German Chancellor Schulz, that we, to the effect that we have freedom of expression here in Germany or here in the United Kingdom, except for hate speech. And they don't see any internal inconsistency in that, because their view is that hate speech, and this is a view bolstered by the European Court of Human Rights, is so odious that it's outside of the right to freedom of expression, that it's excluded from it. This is borne by a kind of an impulse to try and hold together multi-ethnic, multicultural societies. You may have seen recently, in a different context, a senior politician in Australia made the remark that if you're going to have a multicultural, multi-ethnic society, you need to control freedom of expression. You can't have both, because the view, and that is a view that's very resonant here in the United Kingdom and in Europe, is that genuine freedom of expression will allow people to start to challenge the shibboleths and the sacred cows and the deeply held beliefs of people like, let's say, the Muslim community, and they'll respond violently to it. That's at the core of this. And this is, if you read some of the thinking from the UK government, from Home Office reports, which is the kind of the internal security branch of the British government, they make the point that hate speech has the potential to quickly degenerate into physical violence and ratchet up community tensions. And because there's no tradition really of kind of First Amendment or anything as emblematic and as powerful legally as that here in Europe, the only thing that would be comparable really, and I'm reluctant to even use the term comparable, would be Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights. But Article 10, one, you know, grants the right to freedom of expression, but Article 10, two immediately then sets up all of the exemptions and so on. And they include things like public order. And this is where the concern arises, that if you have, for example, somebody burning the Quran, or condemning Islam, or in any way even criticizing migration or the people who are supporting migration, like politicians who might be of that view, that is one step away then from physical violence. And you may have seen the case in the United Kingdom where a man decided to go outside the Iranian embassy and burn the Quran. He was attacked immediately by two passersby who were Islamic. One of them stabbed him. And the police arrived on the scene and they arrested the guy who burned the Quran, and no prosecution was brought against the chap who stabbed him. Now, you people might say, well, that's an aberration. Clearly, that was a mistake. But I would actually point to multiple cases in the UK where the prosecution and the police service have cracked down more strongly on those who are engaged in provocative speech than they have against people who are actually using physical violence. There's a whole phenomenon in the United Kingdom now called two-tier policing, where if you are from a community that is regarded as a minority and historically oppressed, they will be treated in a different way than the perception of the dominant community, usually Christian, ethnically British people who are engaged in public criticism of Islam or migration generally. LGBT is probably slightly separate, but again, the impulse is through policymakers to control critical speech of that community, because it will result then in violence or persecution. And that's in their view that there's historical precedent for that. And so while it's not anticipated that there's a violent reaction from the LGBT community, so-called, to critical speech, it's the view that uncontrolled critical speech will lead to all kinds of negative externalities for the society. The other thing to remember as well is that after the Second World War, because of the trauma caused by the rise of extremism and the resulting destruction in Europe, that a view was taken that liberal democracy could not be left to its own devices. It couldn't be just defended by a purely laissez-faire approach, that it had to be defended robustly against those who would seek to tear it apart. And there is a concept, particularly in Germany, of a kind of fortified or militant liberal democracy, where emerging threats to the social fabric will be taken on directly. So they will ban political parties that are seen as being anti-constitutional. They will prosecute individuals who are engaged in speech that could be seen as trying to erode the rights and freedoms of other peoples. Some may say, well, that's understandable considering Germany's history, but because of the size and the power of Germany as a country in Europe, that approach has been exported, particularly through the European Union and its various legal instruments on hate speech, and has now become really the European norm. So we don't have that First Amendment tradition, and because tensions are growing in European communities as a result of mass migration, the response from the authorities is to crack down even further on free speech that is seen as being disruptive socially in order to forestall the possibility of real physical violence.
So what you describe is the classic heckler's veto, where a particular group is given a great degree of leverage societally, because then it only needs be a matter of a threat. If you say this, if you do this, then a particular, even small wedge group can lever that kind of power and control over what the rest of a society does, thinks, how they act. I know that one of the broad themes that has come out of Europe and England has been the idea of social cohesion. But yet what this does, and reading legal opinions here in the West, the idea that we would set up something like personality rights so that we would have this bucket where those who have certain sensitivities that they believe, you know, must be protected become a particular class. Ultimately, one can see in a Western society that the walking on eggshells situation becomes so challenging that there is little freedom. When general tenor of lawsuits and just coming into your system, do you feel or understand that the law schools and the way that lawyers and judges are trained is at all looking at freedom of speech differently, as far as understanding that in a Western society, the right to express oneself and not be controlled by an element in society that just exists. And you and I both know the examples of translations of what some Islamic clerics would say. We've watched video from England. So whether it's Britain, whether it's even now in the U.S., these things would be characterized as inciting. What you're talking about with this heckler's veto is the idea of that kindling of incitement. And so then, you know, once the match is lit, it doesn't matter. It's who lit the match. It's not what's done and what's burned down afterward. And part of that becomes a matter of our constitutional rights. But how do you think that the law education and the lawyers and judges coming into the system are looking at all this?
Well, I think your concerns are well expressed, because increasingly legal education, of course, particularly in European law schools, places a heavy emphasis on international law. And a lot of these concepts are drawn directly from international law. So if Chapter 10 of the Finnish Criminal Code, where the offence in Pivey's case is found, is a direct example of a piece of international law. Article 20 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights was almost directly translated into Finnish domestic law. And going back a step further, then, when you look at what happened in the negotiation for the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, which the United States is a signatory as well to, Article 20 of that came from the desire of the communist bloc, the Warsaw Pact countries, to include a provision against what they saw as fascism. So it prohibits the incitement to ethnic hatred And of course, if you're in a communist country, a lot of them were had longstanding kind of, let's say, domestic fissures along religious and ethnic lines. The communist worldview was that that would all be kind of wiped away by the arrival of a communist society and all that kind of utopianism. And we know that that was wrong. A good example is when Yugoslavia collapsed into civil war as soon as the communist regime collapsed. They insisted anyway that that would be put into the international law as a counterpoint to Article 19, which protects freedom of expression. Now, so the genesis of this is not neutral. It comes from a worldview that is essentially socialist in some ways. And I don't want to overstate this to say that it's directly communist in its entirely in its fabric, because you know, Germany adopted these things after the Second World War without international, before the ICCPR was introduced. And for the historic reasons that I've already discussed, they felt that it was necessary to create a democratic system that was intolerant of intolerance. But for countries like Finland and other countries that didn't have similar provisions in law, it was imported in by international law. And increasingly, when you have studies at law schools and so on that emphasize the importance of international law, which is particularly the case in virtually every European country that I'm aware of through our own networks, it stands to reason then that lawyers and eventually jurists who come through that educational system will regard these provisions of international law in many ways as ranking pari passu with domestic constitutions and so on. And that's precisely where we found ourselves in the UK, where you have an ancient right to freedom of speech now is counterpointed directly with these kind of more modern concepts that have come in through, not exclusively, but predominantly international law. And I think a lot of people, lawyers in particular, who may not practice in the area, are not aware of the provenance of some of these ideas, and then that they come from, as I say, the socialist bloc. Another point to look at as well, and Pew, the research company, the US research company, have done some very good work on this, looking at attitudes to freedom of expression in Europe. It probably wouldn't surprise anyone to hear that the most hostile population to freedom of expression is Germany, and that within that, then it's young people in Germany, believe it or not, that have an extremely high intolerance for what they call hate speech and so on. And as I say, Germany, being the largest economy in Europe and being politically very powerful, sets the tone in many ways for the regulation of speech in Europe. So because of Germany's historic situation and its preoccupation with trying to avoid the rise of kind of dictatorship again, we're all having to deal with that played out then in European regulation, cracking down on various aspects of freedom of expression. Even though I think Pivey will win her case, and I hope I'm not wrong in that assessment, that will be a very a great thing, obviously, for Pivey personally and for Finland, but it would be just one part of sadly an overall picture in Europe, which is getting gloomier and gloomier. Even though that will be a bright spark, increasingly the instinct of European policymakers is for ever more regulation of speech in the face of ever more divided societies. And this is why when Vice President Vance gave his remarks at the Munich Security Conference in February of last year, it caused consternation among European elites, because it was such a direct challenge to the direction of travel in Europe, which is to more control, more censorship, and so on. The fact that Elon Musk bought X and kind of liberated speech online really has thrown the cat among the pigeons when it came to how these things were going to be dealt with in Europe, because there's no way around this except a showdown with the administration and with X. So long as X commits itself to allowing maximum freedom of speech, it will be regarded as a serious threat to social cohesion in Europe. And it won't surprise you to hear that the current fines against X are just the beginning. They have more open investigations underway, and they're going to keep going really until X either capitulates or they drive it out of business in Europe.
That is a stunning admission. I know that having a platform based in the United States where one can find the entire array of opinions in a discussion is a liberating thing when Westerners are looking for ideas and trying to learn the basis for development of different opinions and trends. This is going to be fascinating to watch. And what you speak of as far as the chill, I know is a whole different conversation, because it's not only, as you say, what the ultimate decision is, but it's the example made of someone and an arduous process that they might have had to endure. And I know a lot of pressure comes along with that. So we do need at this point to turn it over to Sarah to see if there are audience questions. And if not, I do have some. So, Sarah, do you have any questions that have come in?
Yes, we've had a few of them. So as we get started, just if you have a question, please make sure to enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of the screen. The first one that we have here says that we've just celebrated the 100th anniversary of Scopes Monkey Trial here in the United States, a trial designed to cross-examine Christianity. Has anyone ever considered placing atheism on trial, as well as to expose its antithesis to free speech and the freedom of conscience?
Well, I don't think anyone, I have certainly not come across any example of atheism being put on trial as such, but it is a protected belief in a number of European jurisdictions. Under the provisions of Article 9 of the European Convention on Human Rights, you have freedom of religion and belief. And so belief is a separate category, and they have held that beliefs such as pacifism and atheism, although I'm not comparing them, but beliefs of that nature are protected in European law. The test they have for it was developed in a case called Bayatian versus Armenia, and it's essentially whether or not the belief system reaches a level of seriousness, cohesion, and cogency to be worthy of respect. So in that case, pacifism, which was somebody who objected to compulsory military service, that was upheld. They have done so similarly for atheistic beliefs, and evidently organized religion obviously falls into a slightly separate category, but it's also protected. However, one thing to observe, there are a number of examples of this I can go into, is that when it comes to protecting religious belief and the expression of religious belief, which is obviously a critical element of protecting religion, because you have to be able to communicate religion. You can't just keep it to yourself, particularly if you're a Christian. It has been again and again the prioritization of things like so-called LGBT identity and protection from offense over Christians being able to freely communicate their beliefs. When it comes to Islam, it's a slightly different category, obviously, where you have two religions in conflict with each other, possibly. But more generally, whether or not atheism or any of those other beliefs are protected, it comes down to the specific characteristics of what is being articulated. But as long as it's sufficiently serious, cogent, coherent, and worthy of respect, the court will uphold it. But alas, for Christians overall, the picture is not good in Europe.
Thank you so much. Another question we have is from Richard Black. If the Finnish decision is positive, will it have a beneficial effect on other EU nations?
Yes, it's not going to be binding precedent outside of Finland, but it can be persuasive, certainly. And it's our intention to take, if we're successful, to take the decision in Pivey's case and to use it as much as we can in similar cases in other jurisdictions. Finland is a respected, mature democracy. it would be regarded as a state with strong rule of law. And therefore, I think a decision of the Finnish Supreme Court would be certainly worthy of consideration by other jurisdictions. And so we'll certainly put it before judges and policymakers whenever we get the opportunity to do so.
Thank you. Another question we have here is there any movement to adopt more robust free speech protections, either in Finland or the European Union? This just seems like a glaring concern for democracy. So I'm wondering how people are reacting locally.
No, the movement is all in the other direction, I'm afraid. It's all for more censorship, more control of speech, particularly online, which is really where the real marketplace of ideas is now, where the public square really is online. And everything we've seen from the European Union has been to crack down further on speech. And sadly, the watchdog in this area, the European Court of Human Rights, has developed an even more incoherent and frankly useless jurisprudence since around 2016-17 when it comes to speech. I think the best thing the best way to think of it is this: that since the decision of the British people in Brexit to leave the European Union, the election of Donald Trump in his first term, and the migrant crisis that led to the rise, so-called, of the far right in Europe, the attitude in Brussels and Strasbourg and Luxembourg and Paris and Berlin has been to view Europe as being in a crisis of significant proportions, where democracy and the rule of law and human rights are all under threat, that it's been driven primarily from online sources, be they kind of bot farms in Russia or Elon Musk's X, or just the internet more generally. And the only answer that they have in their toolkit is to regulate and to punish people who are saying things that are critical of migration, of LGBT, of Islam, and so on. And I don't see any change in direction. As I say, I think it's just going to be worse as time goes on.
Thank you so much. I'll turn it over to Ms. Lugo if she has any additional questions that she would like to ask you.
I do. Several. First, what can America do? Okay, so you mentioned Vice President Vance's remarks. And I know, as I mentioned, I have a lot of correspondence going back and forth with people all over Europe. And there was such excitement. What can the United States do to support, encourage? Specifically, I'm thinking when the U.S. looks at European speech, and you know, the impulse when there is any kind of a problem is to control it. Therefore, you know, if something somebody said is an issue, that becomes the focus rather than what the larger picture indicates, which is, you know, we need to have a cultural debate. I know that in the U.S., you know, our example, free speech is messy, and for public order. And I've written a brief to the Conseil d'Etat in France regarding an issue. And I understand that public order is the sine qua non. It is what it measures everything that's interpreted through the courts when it comes to conduct. Therefore, you know, that on top of that, with all of the migrant issue and the lack of interest in promoting assimilation, there are these very predictable clashes. So what can the United States do as an example? I mean, you as Europeans, the English Enlightenment, Scottish Enlightenment is what informed our founding fathers. And so at some point we have this common core of understanding. What can U.S. citizens, U.S. attorneys do as far as helping to promote the interest in preserving the platform of X and also protecting people who may travel here and pick up a rifle or say something here. And then, you know, I know that President Trump is threatening, oh, if you punish people who are Americans or have visited America and participated in our freedom and then return to be arrested at the airport. So with that relationship between U.S. And EU, what can we do to better foster the need for the priority in having the debate, even though messy?
Yeah, well, you're correct. It's the administration is key, really. Vice President Vance, his interventions here have been enormously useful for us. And then, of course, the president's remarks as well, and the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. If it were not for these interventions, it would be an extremely lonely place in Europe to be defending freedom of speech. We were given a real morale boost across Europe, those of us who kind of fight the corner for free speech, by these statements. And I'd include as well the work of members of your parliament, Congress, thinking particularly of the investigations by Congressman Jim Jordan and his committee into the censorship industrial complex around Twitter and so on, that their work and shining a light on the nature of this problem has been enormously helpful. One step back, I guess, would be to think of this as a transatlantic effort for those who on both sides of the pond are advocates for censorship. It's not just a European mindset. There are plenty of people, as we know now from the investigations that the Judiciary Committee in the House undertook in the United States, who were perfectly happy in the last administration to usher in a censorship regime in your country by the back door through pressure on tech companies. There were a lot of those people who cooperated hand in glove with the European Union as well to try and bring censorship in. In their great wisdom, the founding fathers have sort of given you a key legal protection that we lack. But that's not to say for a moment that if that were not there, that there'd be lots of people in the United States who would be perfectly happy to usher in the same kind of censorship regime that we have in Europe in the name of, you know, protecting minorities and so on. But in reality, it's a political maneuver to protect their own power. You mentioned fascinatingly debate. I've come to the conclusion that European elites are just not interested in a debate. They don't believe that there are better ideas out there waiting to be introduced or threshed around. They are prisoners, effectively, of their own mistakes. And the only thing left for them to do is to stop people from drawing attention to those mistakes. Europe is in a very serious crisis demographically, in terms of integration. We're also in an economic crisis. And these various crises can be traced back in a lot of ways to decisions that were made centrally at the European Union level, as well as, in Germany and France. And we reached a point now where they no longer have any policy answers to this accumulating series of crises. So the only thing they have left is just to stop people from talking about it. And that's why they want to reduce the velocity of controversial opinions on X. It's not really about protecting anyone from, in my opinion, protecting any individual or group from violence, because as we know, there are plenty of ways that the state can respond to the violent conduct already. This is about forestalling systematic political change across the continent. X really is at the vanguard of that. But I mean that quite literally, because if it were not for X, and this has been something that people in the AFD in Germany and the Rassemblement National in France have said, the cordon sanitaire that existed around the nationalist right would still be in effect, and they would be frozen out of the mainstream media and frozen out of political discussion. But the reality is now, thanks to US technology, that they're able to get their message across in an unprecedented way into the phones of millions of European citizens. And that poses an unprecedented threat to to the European Union's grip on the narrative and to domestic elites on their grip on the narrative as well. And that's why they're using these hate speech laws now in ever more creative ways to crack down on dissent. This is not unknown in Europe, frankly. I've made the point before that a lot of European democracies are quite new. I'm here in the British Isles, where we have an older democratic tradition, but France is at a very volatile democracy. It's on constitution number 5 now. Germany, of course, as we know, is constitution is really dates to around 1949-1950. Italy as well, just emerged from fascism after the Second World War with a new constitution. Spain only emerged in the late 70s from Franco, Salazar in Portugal again in the 70s and so on. So if you look across Europe, these are not countries with a long, uninterrupted history of liberal democracy, unlike the United States, which is now in its 250th year. And in that sense, they are newer democracies. I wouldn't say they're weak democracies, but there's still an institutional memory of when those countries were, politically abusive and totalitarian. So there is an element of that as well. And they're incredibly afraid now that as a result of an accumulation of really pretty major policy errors over the last couple of decades, that plus the new technology that allows people to speak freely, that the whole system that they've engineered after the war will collapse and we'll be back into totalitarianism. And J.D. Vance answered this concern very well. He said, if you're going to cancel your election results, as they did in Romania, after a few tweets, that means you have a much weaker democracy than you think you do. If it's not robust enough to stand up to criticism online. So all of these things have kind of come together, intersected at this point. And I cannot see a scenario where there's not going to be a showdown between European policymakers and this administration, particularly on X, but more generally, as Vice President Vance described it, as the kind of civilizational divide that's opening up over free speech.
Just briefly, do attorneys sense risk when being involved with a case that may be politically controversial in this way? I know that during the time that you mentioned in the United there was censorship at government behest, but that was just pressure on social media companies. It was difficult to have conversations, and certainly in the United States, we look at this as generating from the COVID period, but that's when we learned the extent of what that control and pressure was. Do attorneys sense that for career interests or when it's to hiring anything involved with their professional life, are they having to be careful about the cases they take? In this case, Paiva, fortunate to have Alliance Defending Freedom and the work you do and the projects you're involved in. But generally, is there a sense among lawyers that this is a minefield, so to speak?
Yes, is the short answer. We work closely with lawyers across Europe, and our function, in many ways, is to help them bring the case to the international court or to take it ourselves. But it depends on where you are. The further east you are, the newer the democracy, and the more that we have spoken to colleagues who do feel that they are under security services monitoring and so on as a result of having a view that's anti-government. I mean, if you take Romania as an example, the fact that the courts and others stepped in to cancel that election because of what they believed is Russian interference through X shows that there are serious consequences going on here. And it can be very career risky, particularly in those newer democracies. Here in Western Europe, particularly in the United Kingdom, it's not the case to the same extent because being in the Anglosphere, we do have a more mature democracy and better, longer lasting, more instantiated sense of freedom of expression, and so it's less the case that we feel that there's repercussions, particularly in recent years where the tide has turned on in the UK, at least on the censorship efforts. For my colleagues in France and Germany, it's slightly different. I mean, I don't think they fear any official reprisals, but there's still a huge amount of opposition, let's say, at every level, socially and professionally, to having free speech prioritized. And there's one lawyer in particular, Joachim Steinhoffel in Germany, who's spoken to me about the way in which former friends and professional colleagues have kind of distanced themselves as he's become more involved in defending free speech. I think the fact that I'm working for an American organization means that we feel, we have the kind of protection, let's say, of our colleagues in the US on our side. And that is important, not just for the work we do on free speech in Europe, but we also do a lot of work on persecution of Christians in Africa, the Middle East, and India. And, having the US in your corner means that you have a powerful friend. And the fact that this administration has committed itself to defending free speech, it has just been transformative. So we're really delighted with that developed.
Thank you. Sarah, we'll turn it back to you.
Thank you so much. On behalf of the Borderless Society, thank you to Mr. Price for speaking with us today and to Ms. Lugo for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, bedsoc.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.